Hello and welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program this week...
We're still looking at a level of employment that's about 5% lower than we had in February, and working hours that are about 7% lower than we had in February. So we've still got a long way to go.
Employment figures are out today, and whilst they could have been worse, they do not include anything that the latest virus outbreak in Victoria is going to throw at us. We wait with bated breath for what our Treasurer Josh Frydenberg will come up with in next week's mini-budget. Also on the program...
It's true to Australia, it's unique to the world. And I think investing in what really makes our country and our places unique can really help to bring our cities back to life.
Yeah, how our battered but still unbowed creative people can help resurrect our economy. We're going to need some big ideas, and fortunately we have some of the most creative people in the world right here in Australia. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Money. But first, having missed out on our regular budget, which should have been held in May this year, the Treasurer is going to make some announcements in what is being termed a mini-budget or economic statement next week. Most are hoping we're going to find out some of the further developments on the JobKeeper/JobSeeker issues. And to find out more, I asked Professor of Economics David Orsman from the Macquarie University Business School what he thought might be in this year's mini-budget.
First, Rod, it's not really a budget that we're having now. We're going to have a statement by the government on where they see the economy and, in particular, the budget going, given what we've now learned over the last few months. So you're quite right. We would have usually had a formal budget presented to Parliament in May. But, of course, with the numbers all moving around a lot as everyone tried to understand the impact of this virus, the government, I think, quite sensibly postponed that until later on this year.
Do you think we'll see some change to the September job seeker, job keeper cliff that we were heading towards?
Look, I think that's the burning question on everyone's mind, and we're just going to have to wait and see next week. But I do think that you can think about this kind of fiscal pressures in three kind of ways. The first package, we'll say, is kind of emergency measures that were done in March, sort of get money out there to assist with people in handling the impact of the quarantining effects and social distancing and so forth, plus the uncertainty that was so prevalent earlier on this year. That, I think, has been very successful in stabilising the economy and also giving people confidence. But, of course, it's a very expensive approach because it's generalised money to a lot of different people. This phase, I think, is going to be what the government focuses more on in the statement next week, although, again, we'll have to wait and see. And it's more likely to be saying, look, having got over the initial shock and the economy now starting to recover, things reopening and so on, how can we use the budget money in a more targeted manner to be able to bring in the people that are under the most stress, which means you're still having the best, if you like, bang for your buck in terms of getting to people who really need the money, while also sort of starting to bring back some of the costs. The third component, of course, maybe occurs later on, is that one of how do we get growth going again in the economy, which is ultimately a very important part of getting over this cycle, but that maybe is the sort of thing we'll see in the formal budget later on in the year.
We spoke to the Victorian head of the AI group last week, just as Victoria was locking down again, well, Melbourne was particularly. He was saying that this was going to put business back about 6 months in Victoria. If that's the case, we're going to have sort of a bit of a patchy economy to try and fix up.
Well, look, I'm not sure whether it'll be 6 months. Hopefully it'll be a lot less than that. But, you know, the nature of these kind of shocks is that they're never a nice linear path of recovery where there's no sort of wrinkles and ups and downs and so forth. There's always something new going on, even for, you know, where the economies don't have this kind of virus component to it. The virus just adds to that volatility. So it's not too surprising to me that we see kind of, you know, two steps forward and then perhaps one step back, as we're seeing right now. Hopefully, you know, the authorities, the health authorities, both in Victoria and also in New South Wales, are, you know, managing to get on top of this, and that, you know, in a month or so, we're going to look much better.
And, of course, the amount of money that the government is going to have to look at will kind of depend on how many people are out of work. And, of course, the Prime Minister was commenting on the unemployment figures today. He was, I guess, heartened a little bit as to the there are more people out of work, but it could have been worse. But, of course, he also mentioned that the situation in Victoria isn't accounted for in the figures because they're historic.
That's exactly correct on all fronts. So things are better than they could have been in the absence of the assistance that was provided early on in the year, sort of what we were speaking about earlier on. They're starting to come back, which, of course, is a great sign in terms of employment. But, you know, as of early June, which is when the numbers were taken, early June, we're still looking at a level of employment that's about 5% lower than we had in February, and working hours that are about 7% lower than we had in February. So we've still got a long way to go. And traditionally, what we've seen from very large economic shocks before is it takes quite a lot of time until the labour market fully recovers, even back to the level that it was before the shock. And that's likely to be the sort of thing we see this time around as well. So great that we're making progress, but, you know, it's going to still be quite a long slog until we can manage to say that we put this behind us.
A lot of the money that comes in for the budget is from our major exporters, which are generally miners. The iron ore miners have been doing particularly well, thanks to the demand coming from China. How are we going to be travelling, given that we're going to have a lot of the economy and a lot of the money available to us is really going to be dependent upon what happens overseas?
Well, look, you've touched on a couple of issues there, but there is a broader issue than the one you've done. Obviously, you know, we're a large trading country with China in particular. Commodity prices have held up. For us, that's largely to do with the problems in Brazil, by the way, of course, which is also our major competitor in iron ore. And, you know, the more favourable the global environment for us, well, then the better we're going to be able to be for our export side. But the real story for our economy and the real sorts of things that we need in order to basically address not just debt levels, but income standards in general, are the sorts of things that we put in place today, the policies we put in place today to lift our output per hour of work, which is what we call productivity. That's going to be a big question where there's already a beginning of a dialogue going on. There's lots of ideas being bandied around. But that's the sort of thing where we start looking carefully about things like, well, how are we going in our education sector, educating the youth, particularly when they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the unemployment? What are we doing about encouraging companies to adopt new ideas and even existing ideas that are already out there in order to boost output per hour? What are we thinking about for infrastructure and for tax policies and all those sorts of things, which, you know, we know a lot about the ingredients of productivity. We're not too familiar with the exact recipe of how to put it all together, but that's going to be a really important dialogue that we're all going to have in the community, because, you know, everyone has got a stake in that claim and everyone therefore going to make a contribution. So it's not just, coming back to your question, what the external world looks like. A lot of our future prospects are going to be determined by what we decide to do as well.
Well, a lot of us, of course, have been working out how to work from home, and it's certainly been a challenge to try and get everyone working remotely and that sort of thing. Is that going to change things seismically for the future forever, do you think? And is that an addition to productivity that we've learnt in this time?
Look, you've used the right word there. Is it going to change it seismically? as you said. I reckon that there's no question of doubt that since we've all now learned how to Zoom, we've all gone up that steep learning curve, that there's more opportunity for us to have meetings either from home or not having to travel to different destinations and so forth. That is indeed a productivity gain. But, you know, I don't think we're going to a world where we all just stay at home all the time. There are big reasons why we all like getting together in a social setting, and big reasons why we like getting together in a work setting. You know, human beings interact well with each other. That's where many of the sort of the good ideas come, as people just chat in the corridors and so forth. There are reasons why we quite like going to work some of the time, and that is to be with each other. And so I think that while the ability to work from home and the technology is going to be a help, I suspect when all this is said and done, we're probably going to go back to make our work offices look remarkably similar to what we had beforehand, because it wasn't just that we didn't know how to Zoom and Skype well. It was also because we quite like being with each other's company, both at a social setting and also in a work setting as well.
And maybe just coming back to the budget again, when we have the real one coming up towards the end of the year, would you like to be in Josh Frydenberg's shoes?
Well, I think he has a very challenging issue before him, but he also has a terrific opportunity to sort of, you know, draw on the strengths of the Australian economy, which have been so evident for, you know, 20 years or so, and work on how to use those strengths to set in place, you know, a pretty positive future from there. I think economists are pretty optimistic people. We always tend to think that the future is going to be better than the past, and I'd say most of the time that's exactly how it's played out.
The very optimistic Professor of Economics, David Orsman from the Macquarie University Business School, speaking with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. No.
If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
And to help you out working out what's going on in the arcane world of economics and finance, we're going to do a Please Explain with Britt Helen Johansson on what is meant by capital.
Please explain. Please explain.
This week we take a look at capital. No, I don't mean that we travel to Canberra to visit Australia's capital city, but capital, and that's not with capital letters, in economics. As is clear already, capital can have many meanings depending on the context. In economics, this is also the case. Something that can make it a bit confusing when trying to figure out what it means. But here's Dick Bryan, professor in political economy at the University of Sydney, giving us a helping hand.
I think it's one of those words that's taken on a number of different meanings that aren't entirely different, but they are significantly different. So let me try the most general one that's probably almost 1,000 years old, that capital is a term that requires to your wealth. So we would talk about investing capital, meaning how do people invest their wealth.
And guess what? Professor Bryan says in this general meaning of capital as wealth, capital somehow means the same thing as cattle.
Indeed, I think what's a bit interesting here is that the word cattle, as in head of cattle, has exactly the same origin. They're the same word, because cattle used to mean your mobile wealth. It only applied to livestock from about 500 years ago. So that's one notion of capital. How are you investing your capital?
So in a general, broad way, capital is about your wealth and how you invest it. But there are two more meanings. Here's Professor Bryan again.
Another notion of capital we have is capital equipment. So you'll think of a factory and machines in a factory. So that's a second way that in which the term's used. It's obviously not unrelated to the first, but a bit different. And then a third way, which much more comes out of political economy traditions, we'll be talking about capital as in capitalist society and the capitalist, and they'll be talking about the people who own wealth and who control investment decisions in society. So they're all about investment, and they're all about funds of investment, but they just have, you know, one, the last one has a political edge to it, the first one has an accounting edge to it.
So when you have a brilliant idea for a new business, but people tell you, you need capital to start your business, what do they mean? Money? Equipment? Well, they mean firstly money, says Professor Brian, but it can also be equipment.
Probably both, but in the first instance, clearly they're referring to money. So if you need capital to start your business, you'll go to the bank and take out a loan, say, and the bank will give you a fund of money, or, you know, the right to borrow, from which you will buy, you know, shop fittings, you know, all the physical equipment. But you might also need to be buying insurance policies. You might need to be investing in marketing. And so those latter things don't fit our image of bits of machinery.
So capital can mean a few different things. In its broadest meaning, it refers to your wealth and funds, and is often talked about when discussing how you're going to invest your capital or wealth. But it can also be used in a more narrow way, referring to capital as equipment. For example, in a factory, you need machinery. And remember how Professor Brian talked about one meaning of capital being about the capitalist society?
Capital as in capitalist society and the capitalist. And they'll be talking about the people who own wealth and who control investment decisions in society.
Please explain.
Yes, Britt Helen Johansson doing that Please Explain there on capital, which she had plenty of capital ideas coming at her.
Is he right? Is he on the money?
Yes, this is On the Money. Throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of 2SER FM in Sydney, I'm Roderick Chambers. Well, people in the creative arts were the first to be put off when COVID-19 hit, and still theatrical productions, major events, art galleries, concerts, they're all on hold. Yet we have a lot of very valuable people who can help rebuild our societies with the ideas that they have and their innovative capacity. We look at how we can take advantage of the wealth of creativity in our midst. And I asked Tom Payne, an urban planner from Roberts Day, how valuable our creative sector will be to get our economy bubbling along again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, like we've got so much opportunity already sitting in the Australian creative sectors. And I think at the heart of it, you know, in Australia, we've got the Aboriginal story. We've got 60,000 years of Aboriginal culture that, you know, thought to be the oldest in the world. So it tells places of our environment. It's true to Australia. It's unique to the world. And I think, you know, investing in what really makes our country and our places unique can really help to bring our cities back to life.
With the types of cities that we have now, people have changed the way they work. The transport has needed to change. What should we be looking at for the cities of the future for Australia?
Well, I think a fundamental issue that's happened over the last few decades is a lot of our inner city areas have lost employment land as residential demand has risen. So a lot of these businesses that require, you know, large machinery and storage space and all of those things have, you know, sort of steadily being pushed out to the periphery. But I think, you know, cities that create things are the ones, are those cities that project their identity to the world. So by co-locating a mix of uses in more accessible places around, you know, transport, we can help shift our economy of one that's, you know, around transaction and just consumption to one that's a bit more creative and innovative.
Yeah, I like some of the big cities in the world that are regarded as tremendous destinations, London, Paris, New York, Rome, they all have a thriving arts sector, and it's all integrated. You may be doing business a couple of blocks away, and there's an exhibition on somewhere, there's an event on somewhere, there's a show on somewhere. Can you see that we're going to end up coming back to some of that for Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I think the cities that, you know, that spring to mind when you think of great cities around the world, and you've just named a few of them, are those cities that create sort of emotional experiences. You know, for me, I love Copenhagen, I love London, and although Copenhagen's not huge, it's quite iconic. And I think that, you know, you just hit the nail on the head with some of those things. It's, you know, you can move around quite easily. You know, people aren't just in their cars all the time. So there's the ability to socialise on the street. There's these small sort of nooks and crannies in the urban structure. So, you know, there's a sense of intrigue. There's art precincts. And there's this, you know, mix of uses that, you know, people can party, eat, drink, or, you know, even work in the same place. So, and it's not overburdened by highways and towers. So it's a really enjoyable sort of emotional experience. And I think we've really got to work towards that model in Australian cities.
And I think Copenhagen have done a lot of work with pedestrianisation and cycleways and things where you're actually on the street, seeing everything and moving around in a more intimate way.
Yeah, definitely. It's that sort of human interaction and social connection. And I think when we've, you know, a lot of our cities have grown through the period of suburbanisation and the growth of the car. And we've sort of relied on the car for transport. But in doing that, you know, the car makes us quite isolated. You know, when you're walking through a city or cycling through a city, you've got that contact with other people. You can look at them in the eye and you can talk to them. So it creates this really beautiful intimacy. And that doesn't mean that we should, you know, pedestrianise every street, but we can start to look at ways to increase the cyclability and the walkability of some of our neighbourhoods and urban centres.
Yeah, I sort of miss the monorail in a way for Sydney, because you're up high, you can see everything around you, and if it's your first trip to Sydney, you could look at things and going, oh, I really want to go there, and you just get out the next stop and you go there. Whereas if you're in a subway train, you don't know where you are. You come out into the bright light and you have to look for a map or ask somebody.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, for all of its flaws, I think the monorail was, you know, it was kind of iconic. Going back to this idea of cities as having a sort of brand, I think a lot of people did associate the monorail with Sydney. It allowed people to get around and see parts of the city and jump off when they wanted to.
And I should ask you also about some of our more smaller regional areas too, because we have this program going out to many other small towns throughout Australia, or larger towns as well.
Yep.
And really the same principles apply there too, isn't it? There's things which are characteristic of a particular town or a particular area, things that, you know, maybe it's a saddlery, or maybe it's a place where, you know, something was made, a fruit picking area that had a lot of different types of ways of using the fruits and packing them and that sort of thing. There's a lot you can do to make these areas that have perhaps gone out of use, make them something that is an attraction for the town.
Definitely. There's a town that I've been working on. It's in Western New South Wales. It's called Portland. And it was known as the town that built Sydney, because it had this huge cement works there.
Yeah, Portland cement. Yes.
Yeah, and it's got these incredible industrial buildings, and this huge, you know, silos that, and now there's a beautiful mural that's been painted on the side of it. But it's been losing population for a few decades, and now people have started to, you know, say, well, why would I pay, you know, $500,000 to $1 million for a house in Western Sydney when I can buy much cheaper land, and creative people can use these incredible spaces. And it's not just the spaces themselves, but it's it's what that place means. It's got a story to tell. It's got a history, and that comes through in its buildings and its architecture and the stories from the people and the art. So I think, you know, a lot of small towns in Australia have so much potential to tell their story and to create, you know, to build better places that people want to live in.
And I think business people often forget that a creative person can make something out of nothing. You can show them something and go, oh, well, you know, we can't use this anymore. And they'll say, well, wait a minute, maybe we could put it over here and do this to it. And then suddenly it'll be something.
Exactly. There's a sense of ingenuity, I think, with creative people. And I think when you want to, you know, when you've got that creative way of thinking, it's not just, you know, creating dollars at the forefront. It's how can we make something cool? How can we get our friends involved? How can we do something that people are going to look at? And then, you know, the ball starts to roll and it develops into something really interesting and cool. So you never know.
Yeah, Tom Payne, an urban planner from Roberts Day, speaking with me there about what we're going to do when we want to dig ourselves out of this hole. And I think there's a lot of creative people that are going to help us do that. This is On the Money. And that's about it for us here on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producer, Britt Helen Johansson, this week. On the Money is produced at the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcast. New episodes coming out. We'll see. We'll see when the next one's coming out. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser. And find us on Facebook and Instagram for updates. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do look after yourself. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
My dope like ooh wee, and I smoke like ooh 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 wee. Man, it's time to get this money, and I always be getting it. Ooh wee, let them boys go up in the city. Turned up to the max with that pack, I gotta get it. I ain't never gonna stop, too legit to quit it. Ooh wee, I be dabbing, ooh wee, I got the hand it. The minute looking at me, boy, you know I got the credit. Two thrown up in the game. Smoke like ooh 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 wee. Yo, bitch like nigga.